From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm Mary Beth Maziarz.
This morning we speak with neurosurgeon Dr. Kevin Tracy. He is a leading expert on the vagus nerve. Dr. Tracy discusses the role of the vagus nerve in health and disease, explaining that it has 100,000 fibers and regulates inflammation and homeostasis.
Tracy highlights recent clinical trials showing significant benefits of vagus nerve stimulation for autoimmune disorders like rheumatoid arthritis and even improvement in depression for some.
Stay tuned for this conversation about a promising innovation. We are airing it in two parts, speaking with Dr. Tracy the entire show this morning. Welcome back to The Mountain Life. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm Mary Beth Maziarz. The vagus nerve is the body's most powerful yet underutilized healing pathway, now discovered to be capable of reversing devastating illnesses without drugs. But what is the vagus nerve?
In three decades of research, our next guest, brain surgeon Dr. Kevin Tracy, unveils how to unlock the groundbreaking science of the vagus nerve. Dr. Tracy is the president of Feinstein Institutes at Northwell Health. He's an inventor of more than 120 U.S. patents and one of the most highly cited living scientists in the world. He's also the author of a new book called The Great Nerve, How the New Science of the Vagus Nerve and The Great Nerve, The New Science of the Vagus Nerve and How to Harness Its Healing Reflexes. Dr. Kevin Tracy, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Thank you for having me on. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, I have wanted to speak to you for some time because I feel like in the research I've done, you are the person to talk to about the vagus nerve. And there's been all of this talk recently, media coverage about this new thing with the vagus nerve, which is interesting because, as we know, you know, the vagus nerve has been around as long as our bodies have been around. So tell us first, what is the vagus nerve and what does it control?
The vagus nerve is like an information superhighway that connects your brain to your body and all the organs in your body that you frankly don't think about. We call it the vagus nerve, but you actually have two of them, like two thumbs and two kidneys, one on each side of your neck. It starts at the base of your brain at about the level of your eardrums on each side, travels down your neck and chest and into your abdomen. But within each of these two vagus nerve trunks, you actually have about 100,000 vagus nerve fibers. So one way to think about this is that you don't have a vagus nerve, you have 200,000 vagus nerves. And over millions of years of evolution, each of these fibers has been selected for a specific function, a specific role in keeping your body in homeostasis. The vagus nerve, by carrying this information back and forth between the body and the brain, the vagus nerve is providing the crucial network of reflexes that keeps your organs functioning in a very balanced, harmonious way. And that's key to health.
Yes. And as I understand, it's the only nerve in your body that if you cut through it, you'll die.
Both sides
of it. So, but what we're going to talk with you about today is this work that you've been doing, you know, researching for several decades about how we can harness this power that we didn't know before, that you sort of stumbled upon a bit accidentally, researchers stumbled on accidentally, how it may help reduce inflammation and everything. It's all about inflammation in our bodies now, right?
Inflammation has a role in many of the unsolved or poorly treated diseases of the human race today across the globe, whether it's autoimmune diseases or auto-inflammatory diseases, whether it's sepsis. But the problem of inflammation actually extends into other conditions that aren't commonly by most thought of as having a component of inflammation, but it does. Cancer, heart disease, stroke, Alzheimer's disease and neurodegeneration, ALS. The list goes on and on. Metabolic syndrome, hypertension, diabetes. So I like to ask the question, If it was possible to cure inflammation, which today we cannot do, we don't know how to cure inflammation. When we treat inflammation today, we treat the signs and symptoms. But what if we could stop inflammation in its tracks, or frankly, dial it down to the point that the damage inflammation was causing in these conditions was actually now converted to a healing type of response, of immune response. And that's the hope, and that's the fundamental discovery that my laboratory made some 25, 30 years ago in a, as you said, a surreptitious finding in the lab. It was unexpected. We discovered that the brain sends signals through the vagus nerve, and that these signals restore a healthy balance to the amount of inflammation in your body. And this was back in the late 1990s, and I sketched on the back of a napkin. If we could somehow control the signals in a vagus nerve of patients with rheumatoid arthritis, and if we could use these signals to restore the balance, the amount of inflammation in their bodies, could we actually help these patients have less pain from rheumatoid arthritis, perhaps inflammatory bowel disease, multiple sclerosis? And as of last fall, the first clinical trials in the U.S. to address that question were completed, and the answer is yes. In patients with severe rheumatoid arthritis, now these are patients who are taking powerful immunosuppressive drugs, but still not gaining sufficient benefit from these therapies. What we saw in 242 patients across 40 medical centers in the United States is that many of them had significant clinical benefit from having a vagus nerve stimulator implanted in their left neck to activate this pathway that my colleagues and I had discovered 30 years ago.
Could you explain a little bit about how the stimulation affects these conditions that the body is having? Is it like it's distracting the body, like a TENS machine, or is it more that it's actually shifting something? Help us understand.
The signals in the vagus nerve originate in the base of the brain, and they activate specific fibers in the vagus nerve that use acetylcholine as a neurotransmitter. These fibers descend down into the abdomen and activate a second group of neurons that has its origin in a bundle of fibers called the ganglia. These fibers project into the spleen. They secrete actually norepinephrine as a neurotransmitter. The norepinephrine is interacting with the white blood cells living in the spleen called resident macrophages. The norepinephrine released in the spleen activates a subset of cells called lymphocytes or T cells that are specialized to make acetylcholine. The acetylcholine in the spleen now interacts with macrophages living in the spleen that are making cytokines. And it's the cytokines that have names like TNF that are actually causing the inflammation. So the end of the line is a conversion of an electrical signal from the vagus nerve to a chemical signal in the spleen that's turning off cytokines that contribute to the actual pain and swelling and redness in the joints. Because the cells from the spleen and the cytokines from the spleen can travel to the joints where it causes the pain and swelling characteristic of rheumatoid arthritis. So that's the scientific answer to your question. The simple answer is, in many ways, we understand this better about how it works to stop inflammation than we actually understand how many drugs work. It's quite remarkable, actually, the depth of knowledge that we have. And this work hasn't all just been done in my lab. The findings started in my lab years ago, as we said, but virtually everything I just described has been replicated by laboratories around the world. This is a detailed understanding of what we call the molecular mechanism or the neuroscience mechanism of how it works.
Well, that is fascinating. Granted, I'm not a doctor in any way, but I've always been raised to believe that the body does have a purpose for the things it does. And so is there any issue with basically changing the way the body is responding? Is there sometimes a purpose for inflammation that we have to be careful about?
There is absolutely a beneficial purpose for inflammation. Let's start with what is inflammation. So inflammation is defined by early Greek and Roman physicians as the appearance of redness and swelling and heat and pain that happens when you have an infection or an injury. So when you sprain your ankle, it gets red and painful and swollen. When you have an infected abscess or a boil on your arm, it gets red and swollen and painful. And this is how we define inflammation now, even after 2,000 years. Now, why, as you say, do we have this inflammation? Why did mammalian evolution select this over millions of years as a response to injury and infection? Because it's important for healing. The early inflammatory response fights off infection and accelerates the healing of a sprained ankle or of a tissue injury. So that's all good. The problem is, in a healing response, the key to inflammation is it has to resolve. It has to stop. And so now you have a system of checks and balances that evolve to control the inflammation. And for instance, one of those checks and balances is that during inflammation, your body starts to release steroids. And steroids from your adrenal gland are anti-inflammatory. And they help the inflammation stop and prevent excessive damage. But in some conditions like rheumatoid arthritis, the inflammation continues after some unknown starting event, initiating event, and this continuing inflammation is the reason for the redness and the pain and the swollen joints in the hands and elbows and knees of patients with rheumatoid arthritis. So that what we discovered came as a surprise, because before this kind of work, people hadn't thought that the nervous system would control inflammation as a reflex, like it controls heart rate or blood pressure. But that's the basic discovery. The signals in the vagus nerve are activated by the presence of inflammation, and they dial it back down. Now, what's really important about the answer to this question is, when we use powerful anti-inflammatory drugs like the biologics that are monoclonal antibodies that block TNF, they block all of the TNF activity, all of the inflammation, and that causes immunosuppression. And as you indicated in your question, that actually is bad for you. If you have no inflammatory response, then you become subjected to the risk that you can't fight off infection. You become subjected to the possibility that you might get cancer, because your immune system is not there to fight off the infection or the cancer. So that is immunosuppression. The good news is, with vagus nerve stimulation now, after working on this for, as you said, 3 decades, we are not seeing immunosuppression. The vagus nerve reflex, well, we call it the inflammatory reflex, that controls inflammation, actually reduces the amount of inflammation from a dangerous level, a damaging level, down to a healthy level, but it never drives it to zero. We've never seen a vagus nerve stimulation case in either laboratory experiments or clinical trials where the vagus nerve therapy drove the immune response into a situation of immunosuppression. It's restoring a healthy balance. We're actually targeting a healthy balancing reflex that evolved over millions of years, and we're just restoring it to a useful function.
Dr. Tracy, I'm wondering why you think that autoimmune diseases are on the rise, which they are. It seems like, you know, just out of 10 people, you know, 8 of them have some kind of autoimmune response in their bodies. What's going haywire? Is it with the vagus nerve, or what's happening in our bodies?
No one knows. There is a tremendous interest in answering that question. Is it something in the environment? Is it something in our food supply? Is it something that we're doing with some other lifestyle? Is it a virus? Is it some other infectious event that's occurring quietly in patients and ends with the onset of an autoimmune condition? No one knows. It's a very important scientific and medical question. What is it possible that damage or dysfunction of the vagus nerve is contributing to it? Yes, it is. In some cases, it's entirely possible. We don't have all the answers on this yet. It's going to require a great deal more clinical investigation and clinical trial work. But early clinical research has suggested, if you look at family members, for instance, of patients with, say, rheumatoid arthritis or some other autoimmune condition, and these family members don't have the condition, but they are at some increased risk for it because of their genetics. The question is, How is their vagus nerve function compared to control population of healthy individuals not at risk for autism? Turns out that there is evidence when you look at measures such as heart rate variability, which is one way to assess function in the vagus nerve. There's evidence that heart rate variability is impaired in the relatives of patients with autoimmune disease. So I've asked the question in scientific forums and in publications, is it possible that the vagus nerve damage or vagus nerve dysfunction or an impaired inflammatory reflex contributes to the onset of autoimmune diseases in some cases? And I think the answer is yes, but that's not proved yet. It's possible from the evidence that exists so far, but more work is going to be necessary before we can make a concrete statement. We all, you know, this was a really important conversation after COVID, because work out of Madrid, Spain, a few years back, asked the question, looking at first at autopsies of people who had died from COVID, and then later at patients with long COVID who agreed to have their vagus nerve studied using MRIs and ultrasound and other imaging technology. And there's clear evidence that some COVID patients, perhaps as many as 1 in 5, have damage to their vagus nerve caused by the infection. And the infection appears in the vagus nerves of some of these patients, and so does inflammation. And so it's possible that a damaged vagus nerve, like cutting the brakes on your car when you're barreling down a mountain, that damaging the vagus nerve would prevent its normal function of being a braking effect on inflammation. And so maybe it may be a contributing factor to autoimmunity in some patients.
Okay, so, you know, when I first read about this device is implanted that you and your associates have invented to give little electrical stimulation to your vagus nerve, the first thing I thought is, wow, that's really promising, but that's also really scary, because your vagus nerve is controlling your parasympathetic nervous system and, you know, your heartbeat, you know, the way your organs function. How do you separate out how it's going to affect your organs versus how it's going to affect your inflammation?
So I will answer that, but before I do that, let's talk about what scary is. You're a patient with rheumatoid arthritis or lupus, inflammatory bowel disease, or multiple sclerosis. You're suffering every day. You can't button your blouse to go to work. You have to have your husband or your spouse or your child help you get dressed because of this pain. And you're taking drugs that are injectable. They're invasive. They cost sometimes $100,000 a year. And the side effect warnings of these drugs include death as a possible side effect from risks of sepsis or cancer or other consequences of immunosuppression. So that's scary. The patients who would be potentially treated with this new approach of having a vagus nerve stimulator implanted are extremely interested in signing up. And we know this from talking to them and from surveys that have been done. So what will be done? As of last fall, a company that I co-founded in 2007, and I'm not an active insider in the company. I assist the company as a consultant, but the opinions I'm expressing are my own. But last November, the company announced the results of a trial. As I said before, in patients with rheumatoid arthritis, many of them had a very significant clinical effect, despite having tried all these medications I described previously. The device is about the size of a multivitamin, and it sits on the vagus nerve on the left side of the neck. And you're absolutely right. It sits on the nerve that controls so many organs and so many functions and so many reflexes. But here, the researchers, my colleagues and I, got a little bit of a lucky break, because it turns out that of these 100,000 fibers that control all these organ functions, we estimate a few hundred, or perhaps at most a few thousand of them, turn off the inflammatory responses in the spleen. And what we found is that those fibers can be stimulated. Remember, we're stimulating the brakes. So those fibers can be activated by a very small amount of current, pulses of electric current for 1 minute a day, on the order of 400 to 600 microamps. This is a trivial amount. For instance, in order to activate the vagus nerve to slow the heart or have significant effects on twitching of muscles, you would need to add 10 times that amount of current. So what we saw in these patients is that by setting the device so that it would be activated 1 minute a day at about 500 microamps, many of these patients at 4:30 in the morning, many of these patients slept through their therapy and had no known side effects. So we are quite optimistic about the safety of this. There were no serious adverse events seen in that trial. And if you were to compare the serious adverse event rate from this trial of a vagus nerve implant to historic and much larger adverse event rates from trials of, say, biologics, the vagus nerve stimulator to start appears to be safer.
This is fascinating. And so some people are at the level where a vagus nerve stimulator sounds like it could be life-changing. I have a brother who has Crohn's disease or ulcerative colitis, and I was noticing some of the things, and I'm definitely going to pass on this information to him. But for those of us who might be suffering from just everyday inflammation or wanting to do some things, are there lifestyle changes that we could adopt that might help our vagus nerve be its healthiest?
Yes, I think there probably are. This is a long, complicated answer to your question, as you framed it. But before we get into the lifestyle changes, you know, you mentioned your brother with inflammatory bowel disease. I think there is going to be tremendous interest in patients who are going to be asking about and seeking this kind of therapy for these kinds of conditions. In the United States, the first indication will be for rheumatoid arthritis. As we speak, the FDA is reviewing some 18,000 pages of data from the registration trial that SetPoint Medical completed last November. I'm speaking personally, I'm optimistic and hopeful that the FDA proceeds with approval, but then that will be for rheumatoid arthritis patients. There will have to be additional clinical trials for Crohn's disease and other conditions. I fully expect those will happen. I think you're gonna see very soon clinical trials for multiple sclerosis. I think those will come sooner rather than later. So that's really why I wrote a book. I wrote a book called The Great Nerve in order to provide this kind of information to people asking these kinds of questions. There are many, many questions about, can I do this at home? And, you know, what are the risks and what are the benefits and will it work for my condition? The problem that I found in confronting these questions is when you look at social media or when you look on even just Googling it, you come across billions of web impressions and millions, if not billions, of social media posts that are offering very confusing and conflicting data about what you can do at home. And so in the book, I really break it down for what we know and is scientifically, factually correct, and what is possible, but either understudy or should be studied, and where has there been, frankly, too much hope and exaggeration and snake oil promises. So the simplest thing you can do is what your primary care physician and probably your grandmother told you to do. Eat a balanced diet, get enough rest, get regular exercise, try to get enough sleep, and try to have a strategy to either minimize or manage anxiety in your life. All five of those things have been associated with slowing your resting heart rate. And if your resting heart rate is slower, that means your vagus nerve is working better. That's the simplest answer. And what's so fascinating about that answer is that large population studies, huge clinical research from places like Framingham, Massachusetts, and from France, actually show that on a population basis, populations with slower resting heart rates have longer lifespans and longer health spans than populations with faster resting heart rates. Now, before you check your pulse and say, oh my goodness, my pulse is 95, I'm gonna die young. It doesn't work that way. You can't take population data and apply it to make a prediction about an individual. That's how the lottery works, right? But it is fascinating at the level of basic physiology that the key function of the vagus nerve to the heart is to slow heart rate. And the question we have, we and my colleagues around the world, many of us are studying this, you know, all of us can walk and chew gum at the same time. You have 200,000 vagus nerve fibers. Some of them go to the heart. Some of them go to your voice box, your larynx. Some of them go to your lungs. Some of them go to your spleen. Does it mean that when we slow our heart rates and we've increased that function of those vagus nerve fibers, does it mean we've also sent an anti-inflammatory signal to the spleen through different fibers? Maybe, hopefully. But those are the kinds of questions we're grappling with in the lab now.
So mostly rheumatologists know about this.
Well, not really. No, that's why I wrote the book too. I mean, patients are, you know, your podcast will do as much to drive patients to tell their doctor, give me this darn thing. You know, doctors are not in any hurry to do this. They don't drive change. They can't. They have other things they have to do. I mean, I'm a doctor. I'm not criticizing them. I understand. They don't drive change. You know, Mary Tyler Moore advocating for diabetes and the pink ribbons on the football players for breast cancer. That's what drives change, not the doctors. The patients are going to give my book to their doctor. That's what I think is going to happen.
So I can wrap my head around the physiology of it, and you explained it really well. I'm sure that was hypersimplified for the layperson, but I noticed too that it has promise for depression. And I'm so curious about that because depression seems like it can be caused by multiple factors, and it's, you think of it more as a brain thing. So how can the vagus nerve affect depression?
This question and the answer are extraordinarily important because of the increasing incidence and problem of depression worldwide, affecting so many. The fundamental answer is there is no consensus agreement on what causes depression. So if you've got a major global problem and no agreement on what's causing it, right out of the box, you have the opportunity and actually the cry for a lot more research that has to be done. Now, how did the vagus nerve stimulation get linked to depression? It came about because the first use of vagus nerve stimulation in the clinic was for patients with epilepsy. And this was approved by the US FDA all the way back in the 1990s and soon after by the European FDA. So there's a nearly four decade experience of using vagus nerve stimulation. I estimated more than at least 250,000 people have had vagus nerve stimulation for the treatment of epilepsy that didn't respond to medications. And what we learned from that is, first of all, it's safe. And second, it doesn't cause immunosuppression. It doesn't have a black box warning like the biologics do. But the other thing that happened is it didn't work in everybody. Some patients continued to have problems with their epilepsy and fits and seizures. And the surgeon said, well, I'll take your device out. I'll remove it. And the patient said, no, leave it in. And the doctor said, why? And they said, because it makes me feel better. It makes me happier. And so based on that, true story. And so based on that, several different groups launched clinical trials in treating depression. And this has gone on now for decades. The FDA has approved in the U.S., FDA in Europe and the U.S. have both approved vagus nerve stimulation for patients with severe depression not responding to medication. But in the U.S., not all the insurance companies are covering the expense, and so that has limited its use. And there's been, frankly, a lot of controversy. We don't know how it works. We don't know why sending signals in the vagus nerve up into the brain would help depression. And we don't know if potentially sending signals down the vagus nerve to stop inflammation in the body may also be helping depression, because we don't know what causes depression. And so with a 50% response rate, it's been very difficult for any consensus to be made on when to use vagus nerve stimulation. I am a strong advocate that more work needs to be done to understand this, because although it doesn't help all patients with depression and it can't be recommended as a global cure-all, nothing's a cure-all. It's not going to be a cure-all in arthritis. It's not going to be a cure-all in inflammatory bowel disease. But I put the challenge out there because some of the patients that have been, if not cured, at least significantly benefited from vagus nerve stimulation went from being suicidal and unable to go to work and unable to care for their families or to be a threat to society. Some of these patients are in fact no longer suicidal, no longer a threat to society, now able to care for them, going to work. So the challenge, I think, is on researchers, scientists, and medical researchers, all of us, to figure out in those patients that do benefit, why? How is it working? Because if we knew how it was working, if we knew what happened in the patients that benefited, is it because signals went into the brain and activated a brain center that enhanced happiness? Or is it because signals went into the body and shut down inflammation? And actually, unknown inflammation in the body was causing the depression in those patients, which is definitely possible.
Sure.
But we don't know. And so this is something that you can tell by my answer gets my dander up, because this really should be confronted aggressively, because we can do vagus nerve stimulation safely. It could help a lot of people, but we need to understand how it works in depression and then how to select patients to be treated in this way. You can't give it to everybody with depression. It won't work that way.
Yeah. So what does it take to, you know, what's going on currently? Say I am a person with rheumatoid arthritis. It's been determined that I would be a good candidate for it. You know, how am I able to get this little device implanted and get that electrical charge?
The first step is we have to wait for FDA approval in the United States. It's possible they will want additional information or ask for some other work. And so we don't know when the FDA approval would come. We hope it'll come in the coming months. We hope it will come this year, but I don't know. So that's the first step. There has to be FDA approval before physicians can recommend this for patients. As I said, in rheumatoid arthritis, it's quite likely would be the first indication. Second, it'll be for not all rheumatoid arthritis patients. It'll be for rheumatoid arthritis patients probably that looked like the candidates or the subjects that were enrolled in the clinical trial over the last 2 years. So most of these subjects had rheumatoid arthritis for several years. They had been on multiple medications, including steroids and DMARDs and methotrexate. And many of them, if not all, had also either been treated with a biologic like an anti-TNF and either could not tolerate it because of the side effects or did not have a clinical response to that. So now we're down to probably on the order of around 1 million patients in the United States who would be eligible for consideration of treatment by this new method of vagus nerve stimulation. At that point, the rheumatologist would have to collaborate with the neurosurgeon at a medical center that will have access to these devices. The company SetPoint Medical will have to coordinate a launch of the product. It'll probably be at selected centers. At Northwell Health, where the Feinstein Institute is located in New York, just this week, actually today, we announced the opening of a new center for bioelectronic medicine, which will be a treatment center for patients and rheumatologists and neurosurgeons and gastroenterologists and neurologists to convene and discuss cases and decide when it would be appropriate to then go ahead and implant the device. The actual implantation of the device is a same-day surgery. So you come in the morning, the incision is only about an inch long, give or take, inch and a half. Procedure takes about an hour, plus or minus 30 minutes. And after recovering from the surgery, patient goes home the same day and comes back to their rheumatologist or their gastroenterologist someday, perhaps, as we said, after future clinical trials, every 6 or 8 weeks. Now, that was by agreement between many discussions with the rheumatologists and the patients. Patients with serious acute and chronic conditions like rheumatoid arthritis want to be seen by their physician on a regular basis. And so with every 8 weeks or so, 6 or 8 weeks, the physician will examine the patient, do whatever testing is necessary, and then adjust how the device is functioning 1 minute a day, turn the power up or down, because the device will communicate with a tablet, the physician's tablet. And that will be the prescription, or that will be the treatment, is adjusting the the computer chip in the neck by setting the settings on a tablet that's communicating with it.
So interesting. I just wanted to mention for our listeners that the very first chapter of your book, The Great Nerve, is how electricity could replace your medications. And it's funny about our electrical system in our body. Every time I go to the physical therapist and they put the stim machine on your tight muscle or your trigger point, I always wonder sort of how it works and how it interacts with our own electrical system. So that's I'm sure it's a very good layman's sort of explanation about how our body's electrical system works.
It's a very important question, and you quickly run into a semantic problem. We're very limited in the semantics of this. So let's take a second to talk about the difference between electricity in the body and electricity traveling in the copper wires of your house. So electricity traveling in the copper wires when you throw the light switch in your kitchen happens almost at the speed of light. There's a rapid movement of charge across this wire that activates the light when the switch completes the circuit to close the difference in the voltage across the circuit. And that's sort of how electricity is defined in the context of physics. There's voltage, there's resistance, and there's current flow. But that's not really what happens in your nervous system. In your nervous system, the signals travel along the nerve at a slow fraction, a tiny fraction of the speed of electrons traveling in a copper wire. And it doesn't travel as electrons flowing along the nerve. The information actually travels as voltage spikes that pop up and are separated in time, one from the other. And each voltage spike pushes the next voltage spike to appear. And then these propagate down the line, almost like dominoes. It's very, very different process. They come together when we use, either in the lab or in the clinic, we use what we call neuromodulating devices, which give not a steady stream of electricity into the nerve like you would do if you were rewiring your kitchen lights. What we do is we give bursts of electricity, pulses, maybe on the order of a few hundred microseconds. And these pulses actually go on and off very quickly. And that is what is actually stimulating the nerve to fire its own nerve signals. It's not driving electrons down the wire. It's very different. And so when you put a TENS unit on your sore shoulder or your sore muscle, what you're actually doing is putting in bursts of electric charge on the order of, say, a few hundred microseconds at maybe 30 hertz or 50 hertz. And that is what is stimulating the nerves in your skin and just below your skin. And that's what we do when we stimulate the vagus nerve. The vagus nerve stimulator is implanted directly on the vagus nerve. And these very small amounts of current, as I said earlier, maybe 500 microamps or 400 to 600 microamps, are fired in pulses at an order of 30 to 50 hertz for a few hundred microseconds.
If you're a person who's interested in health and integrative medicine, this is a book you're definitely going to want to check out, The Great Nerve, because just as in your speaking style, it balances, it straddles the words, the worlds of science and understandability in a really accessible way. So thank you, Dr. Tracy, for your book. Do you imagine a world in which everyone uses bioelectric medicine to address their ailments?
Vagus nerve stimulation, I believe and hope and pray, will help millions of people in the coming years with serious medical conditions. The first series of events will be using this in patients with serious medical conditions. And as the experience and knowledge of who it helps and who it doesn't, it won't help. It's not going to help everybody. You know, I think you're going to see a significant number of people that get significant benefit. I've met many patients now who went from taking powerful immunosuppressive drugs to taking no medications. And I tell some of their stories. I've also met patients who did not have such a huge clinical benefit And they continued to take their drugs, but now they're taking them in lower doses, and they perceive significant benefit because they don't have to take as many medications. And then there's a third group that doesn't seem to derive any benefit whatsoever. So that's what I predict will happen in the coming years. But after that, as experience grows and knowledge of how safe this actually is spreads, people, I predict, are going to start asking new research questions. Can we give this to patients at risk for cancer because they have excessive inflammation, say chronic pancreatitis? Can we give this to patients at risk from heart attack because they have evidence of coronary artery disease or cerebrovascular disease, not serious enough yet to cause a stroke or a heart attack, but can we slow down the progression of the inflammation in those arteries in those patients? Maybe patients with some forms of metabolic syndrome, obesity, or diabetes. Can we reverse the inflammation embedded in their tissues that's causing insulin resistance? And will a vagus nerve stimulator help that? Those are all testable hypotheses. This is not snake oil. These are scientific questions that can be put to the test in laboratory experiments and clinical trials. And I think, frankly, that is the future. I think this is one of the hottest areas in all of medicine and science. And I think it's attracting tremendous interest, not only in academic laboratories around the world, but also in industry. And I think you're going to see an explosion of activity in this space. I mean, we haven't said it yet, but my colleagues and I call the space bioelectronic medicine. I said we opened a center for bioelectronic medicine at Northwell today in New York. And it's called bioelectronic medicine because it's the opportunity to bring together detailed molecular mechanistic understanding with detailed neuroscience mechanisms and understanding, combined with products out of Silicon Valley and biomedical engineering that are coming out faster than anyone can imagine. Then you bring those three things together, and I think it's an opportunity to offer tremendous, tremendous hope for many patients. Mm.
There is just so much promise in your book, The Great Nerve. And I just keep thinking of questions I must ask you. But one for certain, I was gifted the wonderful gift for a recent milestone birthday of this little Aura ring. And I know lots of people are using these wearable devices. And it's just so fascinating. I pay attention to sleep. And then someone said to me the other day, "Oh, what's your heart rate variability?" And I said, "Oh, I don't even pay attention to that," but I've started to, and I've been reading about it. And you talked about heart rate variability and indication of how well maybe your vagus nerve is functioning. Can you just, for those who are curious about that little aspect, heart rate variability, can you talk about that?
Heart rate variability is a measure that is commonly used to indicate what we call vagal tone or resting vagus nerve activity. We talked earlier before about the fact that the simplest way to assess vagus nerve activity to your heart anyways is to look at resting heart rate. What happens when the vagus nerve fibers to your heart are activated, like the brakes on your car, it slows your heart. And what does that mean? Well, it means that it prolongs the distance or the time to the next heartbeat. That's why your heart slows, because the time in between heartbeats is lengthened. That time period between heartbeats is called instantaneous heart rate. Now, if you add up all the instantaneous heart rates, you get measures that can be subjected to sophisticated algorithms and Fourier transformations to look at the distribution of the frequency of all that data. Now, the Aura ring and the Apple Watch and the Fitbit and many, many other wearables give measures of heart rate variability. And as a general principle, you want your heart rate variability to be higher rather than lower. And that reflects increased signals in your vagus nerve, causing variations in your instantaneous heart rate variability at a frequent basis and high frequency. So that's all fine and good. What we don't know is whether the Aura ring and the other wearables are all measuring the same thing. The algorithms are not broadly available. Researchers at places like Columbia University in New York. My colleague Richard Sloan is one of the leading experts in the world on this. And many others have been studying heart rate variability for decades. And there's some consensus on what it means as reflecting vagal tone, but there's also still a lot of questions remaining. The big question for me, at the risk of repeating, again, I think we've talked about it a couple times already, but the fact that your heart rate variability is increased and is a reflection of increased vagal tone to your heart is probably a good sign for maintaining a healthy lifestyle. There's quite a bit of consensus agreement on that. But we don't know how that, at a mechanism level anyways, at a scientific mechanism, we don't know how that correlates to slowing inflammation. You know, we know that aerobically fit people, regular exercise does tend to decrease the risks of inflammatory conditions, but nobody knows the mechanism. Nobody knows why exercise is good for you. You know, you can wave your hands and say it strengthens your heart and gives you better cardiovascular tone. That's all true. But why? Mm-hmm. One possibility is that regular aerobic exercise is increasing your vagal tone and increasing also probably your sympathetic tone, and that together the harmonious balance of those two is very important for long-term health. But these are important new research questions as well. There's a lot of hand waving. There's a lot of hand waving and a lot of do this, do that. That is fine if your doctor says it's okay and it makes you feel better, no problem. But I think we have to be careful about how much we really understand.
Right. Okay, going back to something you said in the beginning of the interview was that with autoimmunity on the rise, there seems to be a specific trigger that brings it on. And I'm wondering if you could expand on that. Do they have any idea of what type of trigger it is? And is it a trigger that affects the vagus nerve, or it just kind of throws your body into disequilibrium?
No one knows the trigger. It's not my area of expertise. I've been focusing on the vagus nerve and activating it to stop inflammation, but my colleagues in immunology and in other areas of autoimmune research, I know some like Betty Diamond at the Feinstein Institute have been pursuing that question for decades. No one knows the answer. No one knows if it is something in the environment. No one knows if it's an infection. And it could be different things in different people. There may be a genetic component in some people, probably not all. If it is a genetic component, it's extremely complicated. It's not like you got the gene from your parents and now have the disease. It's much more complicated than that. So no one knows the answer to your question.
Okay. Dr. Kevin Tracy, it's been such an honor to speak with you today. The new book is The Great Nerve, The New Science of the Vagus Nerve and How to Harness Its Healing Reflexes. Dr. Tracy, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me on. I really enjoyed it, and have a good day.
Now, that Dr. Kevin Tracy and The Great Nerve, a conversation that we don't often take the whole hour to do, but I found myself getting more and more interested in this potential new innovation that sounds like it's just on the cusp of FDA approval.
Yeah, and it's always kind of interesting. I think Big Pharma has inured us a lot to, I don't know, we're just a little bit more suspect of every new thing that comes out because, you know, the idea of curing something anymore doesn't feel like it's profitable. It's better to have something that you have to just maintain. And so something like a vagus nerve stimulator, it's not a drug, but it could be so highly effective and even curative. So it's exciting.
Yeah, it is. And just to mention, as we were talking about off air, was that, you know, we explore these topics on The Mountain Life. And of course, it's nothing that we're promoting, but we want to have an openness to discussing these topics and then allowing our listeners to do their own research, take this and expand their knowledge.
Yeah, because some of the things, you know, might be the biggest breakthrough ever, and some of them may just kind of splash and burn. We just don't, we don't know.
That's right, especially with all this innovation and this sort of entrepreneurial spirit around allowing technology to help us, especially with these health aspects.
Yeah. Oh, even like when we talked with the Oura ring about the you know, health trackers and these different things, and now the glucose monitors. And
yeah.
There's so much that we have these new insights into our body, new ones every month, it feels like.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, certainly a fun conversation.
It sure is.
All right. Well, thanks for tuning in to The Mountain Life here on KPCW Park City. You can find us at kpcw.org or wherever you get your podcasts. We archive all of our shows and turn them into podcasts, so take us with you wherever you go. As always, if you have a show idea, you can send us an email at themountainlife@kpcw.org. And then you had a...
Oh, yeah. And so next week, I'm really excited to share an interview we did with Bill McGowan. He is known as the speaker's guru, and he's just terrific. He has a new book called Speak, Memorably, and it was just a great conversation. Anybody who ever has to speak, even if you're just standing up to give a toast at a table, will find it probably pretty interesting.
Excellent.
Yeah.